For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
We'll get started with Professor Griffith Folk on Dogen's use of koans. Again, let's welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and addressing an audience like this. So I'm going to talk about Dogen's use of koans. You know, for a long time, William Bonifer was talking about the modern Soto view of Dogen, and he didn't mention this, but one characteristic of that is that the view that Dogen did not use koans, and that koans were something used in Rinzai Zen, and this was a way to distinguish Soto Zen from Rinzai Zen. Well, when you begin reading the work of Dogen, you realize immediately how wrong that is. Dogen's writings are filled with comments on koans. He has his own koan collection of 300 koans. He clearly used koans as a central teaching device with his students. And so I am going to talk about Dogen and his use of koans in the second part of my talk, but I think I want to start with koans themselves. So what are koans? This is something you often hear about, but it's widely misunderstood. So I'm going to try in about 10 minutes to make you understand how koans work. Right? Now, they're sometimes called Zen riddles. This is not accurate. It's not a riddle. A koan is a short saying attributed to a Zen master of old, usually in the context of a dialogue with an interlocutor, like someone who asks a question. And that saying is believed to encapsulate some kind of Buddhist wisdom, the master's insight, and thus be worthy of holding up for consideration or comment. Now, many sayings used as koans are striking because they use vivid, sometimes irreverent language. So a monk asked Yunmen, "What is Buddha?" He said, "A dried piece of shit." Okay, that's a famous koan. Right? When I'm done in 10 minutes, you'll understand it. Okay? Or they appear to be non sequiturs. Often like the question implies some kind of interest in Buddhist doctrine. It's asking for an explanation, and the answer just seems off the wall. So some scholars, because of those characteristics of koans, describe them as nonsensical statements intended to stop the workings of the intellect or to sort of cut off discursive or dualistic thinking. And the implication of that totally idiotic interpretation, which is way so wrong, I can't tell you. Like, do you think for 1,000 years people would be interested in this stuff if all it was like some off-the-wall comment which changes the subject? No, that wouldn't happen. But anyway, the implication is that any stupid answer that's irrelevant to the question will serve just as well as any other for a koan. All right? And that's just ridiculous. That's completely ridiculous. So now, the term koan is often translated as public case, but that also is not correct. Ko here means public, but it's a public official, a magistrate or a judge. And in imperial China, the judges or the magistrates in a court had the authority of the emperor. They were appointed by the imperial court, and their word was law. And the an, so that's what a ko is, a magistrate, whose word is law. And an is a bench or a table. So koan means the magistrate's bench. And it's exactly the same sense, like if you go before the bench, you're in court, you're in front of the judge. Okay? That's the root metaphor working here. So a koan, metaphorically, is a case in court. And they're also called old cases. So just like the court of law, the idea is that there are old cases or venerable test cases set a kind of precedent that later judges should take into account. And so the koans are held up as a kind of model or precedent of Buddhist wisdom, but judges still can judge. And just like with precedent, you take the old case into account, but there's a higher court. A judge can pass judgment on an earlier case. So when koans are held up for comment, they're actually held up for judgment as well. And the comment judgment is made from a sort of higher perspective on that earlier case. So anyway, according to this metaphor, the Zen master is like a judge. And the disciples, or the people who question him in this metaphor, are like the accused. And in this metaphor, guilt for the accused means ignorance or deluded thinking. And innocence means awakening or freedom from deluded thinking. But the Zen master will decide, because he's the judge, if you are deluded and guilty or if you are awakened and innocent. And he has that authority. However, you know, having said that, whatever the Zen master says is then subject to further review by another court. Okay, some other Zen master later can comment on that. Now, there were many, many old cases recorded in the Chan and Zen traditions and brought up for commentary. And typically, you know, they're attributed to the ancestral teachers who are famous in the tradition. But once these old cases existed, they were brought up in ritual settings where the abbot in a Zen monastery would get up on a high seat. There'd be a large audience. And people would come forward from the audience and ask the abbot, what about this story? What about that story? What about this koan, that koan? So they could ask the abbot, what about Yunmen's dry piece of shit? Because, you know, you probably want to know, what did that mean anyway? And then the abbot would explain, but he would use the same sort of rhetorical style. So the answer to what did Yunmen mean by a dry piece of shit might be something like, he says, come here. So the monk comes forward and the master hits him. Something like that, right? So the answer, this is a comment on the old case, but it's not necessarily, and usually it's not going to be in a kind of philosophical language. Now also, the masters themselves could raise a case to comment on. So the master can sit up on the high seat, and no one comes forward to the audience. He says, Yunmen's dry piece of shit. And then he comments on that. Like that. Also, these old cases could be used in the abbot's private quarters. So disciples would come in and they would, you know, sort of discuss that koan. What does it mean? And have a kind of debate. So sometimes the questioner in the audience in a public setting, sermon in the Dharma Hall, would ask the question, the master would respond, there'd be a follow-up question, he would respond to that, and these discussions of the koan would also get recorded and would end up in the discourse records, or they're called the Goroku, or recorded sayings of that particular abbot. So we have for Dogen the Eihei Koroku, which was translated by Dan Layton and Shohaku Okumura. You can hold your book up again for a plug. Okay. These are records, many, many records of Dogen standing up in the Dharma Hall, giving sermons, and either someone in the audience raises a koan and he comments on it, or he raises a koan himself and he comments on it. So it's obvious that Dogen used this style of teaching. Now, koans are not nonsensical. This is the point I want to stress. There's a standpoint from which they make sense, and they're perfectly logical. Now, they do involve a lot of wordplay, punning, joking, metaphorical flights of fancy, but all of those are grounded in an understanding of the point being made. You know, it's kind of like if you get involved in telling jokes with someone, You have to understand the previous joke to tell the next joke. And if you don't, you're stuck. You don't know what to say. So, you know, this sort of banter looks like it's jumping all around, but there is a thread, and there's a sense that connects it. Now, the meaning of koans, if that's true, then the meaning of any koan can be explained, can be, in logical, philosophical language. But that's not the rules of the game. The rules of the rhetorical game of commenting on them call for a response in kind, a quip or a gesture or a quotation from another koan. You know, this is very common in Dogen. In Shobo Genzo, he wants to comment on monastic rules, or he wants to comment on the Lotus Sutra, or he wants to comment on a koan, and he'll pull a line from another koan and just say, this is a piece of shit. Just like that. But you have to know, wait a minute, he's quoting Yunmen. You know, and he's saying that my comment on this is like Yunmen's comment when he's asked what is Buddha. And one thing, you know, I'm heavily involved now in translating Dogen's Shobo Genzo. A lot of the difficulty in understanding Dogen in the past has been that people did not recognize that what he said were quotes from koans. They didn't know it. When he quoted the Lotus Sutra, everyone knows that because it's very well known in Japanese Buddhism. When he quotes famous koans, people know it. But throughout Shobo Genzo, you find quotes of obscure koans. And the only reason I found them was through digital text search of the Chinese Buddhist canon. And this is an incredible tool that scholars didn't have before. But could you imagine, I made this one up about the piece of shit, but can you imagine if you didn't know that's a quote, and then suddenly he says that in the middle, it's like, you say, wow, that's really profound. Well, it's not really profound. You just didn't understand at all what's going on. Okay. So a lot of the sort of Dogen's reputation for being obscure is actually based on that kind of ignorance, right? Ignorance of the text he's citing. And most translations of Dogen, I hate to say it, are filled with places where there's missing quotation marks because the translator didn't know it was a quote. Which is, you know, it's just disaster for the translation. Anyway, we can compare Dogen's use of koans with that of Dahui, who was a very eminent Zen master in the Linji or Rinzai tradition about 60 or 70 years before Dogen went to China. And Dahui seems to espouse the use of a single koan to focus the mind intensively in meditation, build up some kind of great ball of doubt, this is Dahui's language, and then have a single breakthrough awakening experience. And if you can understand one koan, according to this, you can understand all of them. And you only need to, like, focus the mind intensively, like, while sitting in meditation, focus on the koan. And, you know, so usually just one word in the koan. So you could focus on piece of shit. Because that would be like the key phrase in that koan. And just focus your mind on that, kind of go into trance on that, and then have some kind of breakthrough and understand everything. That style of koan practice, it's usually called kana zen, is very popular in Korea today. People imagine that that's what modern Japanese Rinzai Zen is about. It's not quite true, because they use many, many koans in Rinzai Zen. But this was not, Dogen wasn't talking about using koans as a kind of device in meditation to attain some kind of breakthrough experience. Rather, I think from his point of view, if you familiarize yourself with koans, you read many of them, you study many of them, you practice commenting on them with a teacher, and later the teacher himself becomes the one who comments. But over a long period of time, it's possible to get a different point of view on the world through familiarity with this koan literature. Not necessarily a single moment of awakening. But there's no doubt, I mean, we heard from William Botterford that according to modern Soto doctrine or interpretations of Dogen, people aren't supposed to be very concerned with awakening. There's criticisms of Rinzai Zen for being Taigo Zen, like awaiting the Zen of waiting for awakening or trying to gain awakening. And this is sort of in Orthodox Soto of the 20th century, this is kind of a no-no. But, you know, but I would say that when you read Dogen, you realize he very clearly distinguishes between people who are awakened and people who are not. He says, those who have attained the way and those who have not yet attained the way. And, you know, and he obviously thinks he's one, and he thinks he can tell whether you know, you're one or not. And so, you know, it's not like in Dogen's writing, the distinction between awakening and not awakening is missing. It's there. It's just not, he doesn't use koans as a kind of instrument to, you know, force awakening. It rather takes place over a longer period of time. Now, the most famous koan used by Dahui, and many of you have probably heard of this, is Jiaozhou's Wu, or Joshu's Mu. So the koan goes like this. A monk asked Jiaozhou, even in a dog, is there Buddha nature or not? And Jiaozhou said, Wu, or in Japanese, Mu. Now, it's standard Buddhist doctrine that all living beings have the Buddha nature. And Wu, or in Chinese, or Mu in Japanese, means does not have, like if I say, you have any money, you say, Wu, no, I don't have any. Okay? Or there is none, that's what it means. So to ask if a dog has Buddha nature, you know, he says, no, there is none. Or no, the dog doesn't have it. Right? Now that flies in the face of standard Buddhist teachings. Now I want to explain it to you like this. To ask if a dog has Buddha nature is just like asking, does Santa Claus have a red suit? And the answer, woo, no, literally, he doesn't have. It's puzzling because every kid knows Santa Claus is dressed in red, right? But if we consider the truth of the matter, Santa Claus does not really exist in any ultimate sense. You know, I mean, I'm a parent, and I talk them up with my young kids, but certainly I don't count on Santa Claus to bring their presents. So if you ask, does Santa Claus have a red suit, the answer is woo, or moo. There is none, or better, no such thing. All right? Now, that example, the Santa Claus example, and I'm going to torment you with it because it's not. I'm not done. But this illustrates two basic Mahayana Buddhist doctrines that koans are grounded in. And the two doctrines are the doctrine of emptiness and its corollary, the doctrine of two truths. Now, the emptiness doctrine very simply states that there's no such thing as a being. There's no such thing as a thing. The concept of a being and the concept of a thing are empty categories. The categories are empty because there's nothing in the real world that meets the criteria. When you think of a thing, you know, it's very clear. It is what it is. It's not other things. It has a discrete boundary around it. It is what it is in some kind of Platonic sense forever. And if you look for things like that in the real world, there aren't any. So thing is a null set, empty concept. Okay, but extremely useful. As a matter of fact, we need the concept of thing to have language. All right. Another example of an empty concept would be a circle, as defined in mathematics. It's a very useful idea. Are there any? What's a circle? Like all the points on the radius are at equal distance from the center, on the circumference are at equal distance, something like that, right? Are there any actual circles in the universe that meet the definition? No. Even the roundest thing that human beings can make, if you like look at it close under an electron microscope, it's got hills and valleys. Not to mention the molecules flying off. Like, is there any such thing as a line? No. All right. Is there any such thing as a thing? No. So this is the Buddhist doctrine of emptiness. Okay. It's a little bit hard to get used to, but from that point of view, because language inevitably involves talking about things, all language is somehow defective. You know, everything we name kind of reifies things in the world in a way that they're not actually in the real world, reifies them. The real world is more dynamic, fluid, than our language makes it seem. So there's a kind of built-in flaw with language. So now the Doctrine of Two Truths basically just states this, that on a conventional level, we can talk about what things are and what are not. On a conventional level, Santa Claus wears red, right? At least in some cultures. My Swiss friend tells me he wears something different in Switzerland. Okay. But the Coca-Cola Santa Claus wears red, right? This is a conventional truth. But the ultimate truth, so anyway, on the conventional level, the world is made up of discrete things or entities that interact with each other, and those things are named according to the conventions of language. You know, so we agree on what to call things. Different languages have different names, and you know, we understand that in some way the names are arbitrary, but they work. Now, ultimate truth in the Buddhist context is that it's not a thing. It's not something you can have an insight about. Ultimate truth is simply the idea that because nothing meets the definition of a dharma or a thing, and because language depends on the concept of things, no verbal statement can ever be ultimately true. You can't describe the world in a way that's ultimately true. Now, this is the underpinning of the koan literature. All right. So you could ask, does Santa Claus have a red suit? The answer could be like Jiaozhou, Wu. No such thing. No such thing as what? No such thing as Santa Claus. No such thing as red suits either. Okay? No such thing as a dog. No such thing as Buddha nature. These are just empty concepts, but they're useful concepts. They're conventionally agreed upon. But if you say that, wow, Jiaozhou is really cool. No such thing. Woo. But that's wrong, isn't it? Because that statement uses the concept of a thing. So that, you know, Jiaozhou, if I'm going to respond to him, he gets a smack, okay? We're saying way too much when he says woo. Does that follow? Yeah. Okay? Now, I did a smack, okay? How many Zen koans have the master just hitting someone? Or you know, the master shouting? Actually, that's, you know, what are you going to say when you can't say anything? And when the question is, is diluted. Like, what is Buddha? That question in itself is flawed. Okay? So, a shout or a blow, it is an appropriate response, but you could also say, woo, no such thing. Okay? Now, I want to take some other famous koans and translate them using Santa Claus. Just make sure you understand them. So, Yunmin was asked, what is Buddha? Another... one time he said dry piece of shit, another time he said an oak tree in the garden. But wow. That's either like drivel, right? Or it's extremely profound. It's a complete non sequitur. What is Buddha? Oak tree in the garden? Okay, but I'm going to say no. What is, when he's asked, what is Buddha, how about saying Santa Claus? All right? That's the answer. Now, that's exactly the same kind of answer. And why is that? Because Santa Claus kind of exists as a story and yet doesn't exist. So what Yunmin is saying is Buddha is exactly that kind of thing. That's what Buddha is. In a certain sense, conventionally, Buddha exists. But from the ultimate point of view, if you're hung up on the idea of Buddha or becoming a Buddha, you have a big problem. There's no such thing. Right? Both at the same time. Now, one of the tricks of the koan rhetoric is that it often uses similes and metaphors, but the words like or as if are left unspoken. So when Newman was asked, what is Buddha? He could have said, if he was a little bit kinder, Buddha is like the oak tree in the garden. Like, make it a simile, Okay? And then you could ask yourself, well, why is the Buddha like an oak tree in the garden? Right? So that like is implicit in the answer, but just to make it difficult for you, the Zen guys take out. You know, they use metaphors all the time, but they never tell you it's a metaphor. They use similes all the time, but they don't tell you. Right? You just get this whole, like, what's Buddha? Oak tree in the garden. Ooh, right? You don't know what to do. So, but put like in. I mean, try it. Works. But also elided from the koan literature are quotation marks. Like, for example, why would Buddha be like an oak tree in the garden? It's not at all. They both grow, they're living things. I mean, you're just way on the wrong track with that kind of thinking. But if you supply the quotation marks, to say Buddha, that the mental act, the conceptual act of saying Buddha is exactly the same as the mental or conceptual act of saying oak tree in the garden. In both cases, you imagine there's a thing there, and you imagine it has a name, right? And from the Buddhist standpoint of the emptiness doctrine, both of those are wrong in the same way, right? So that's a very philosophical explanation of that koan. And I hope that it, gets you, enables you to start to understand it. Now, there's a very famous koan attributed to Linji. He says, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha, right? Okay. How about, if you meet a Santa Claus, kill that Santa Claus? Okay? Now, this sounds really shocking. Kill the Santa Claus? We're supposed to, this is America, we can get guns, okay? So we're going to go down to the mall and find the guys in the red suits who have kids on their laps and boom, 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 okay? Is that what we're talking about? This kind of disgusting violence, I should be careful because you never know in this country, some person's going to hear that. So, I'm a Buddhist, I'm going to go kill Santa Claus. Actually, Santicide, I made up that word. Santicide does not take place in the mall with crazy people. It takes place in our elementary schools. You know why? Because the older kid, the kid says, you know what? Ha ha, there's no such thing as Santa Claus. And the little kid goes, oh no! So that's Santicide, okay? And that's where it really takes place. Now, in the Lotus Sutra, which Dogen loves, the Buddha actually kills himself. He announces that the story of his birth and his career and his attainment of awakening and his turning of the wheel of the Dharma and his nirvana are not really true. He says, that's like a Santa Claus story. He says, I made that up. It's just a skillful means. It's a teaching device. And as a matter of fact, the real Buddha is eternal and always available to all of you, and you should all strive to become Buddhas. That's the message of the Lotus Sutra. And I was thinking about that. I'm still not done with Santa Claus, because after he's dead, all the grown-ups know that Santa Claus is dead, right? So what do? You go tell your children about Santa Claus to keep him alive, and you make sure that your kids have presents, all right? So keeping Santa Claus alive, that means we're Santa Claus, right? And the message of the Lotus Sutra is, we're the Buddha. That other Buddha you thought about, he's dead. But the work of the Buddha, that's got to go on, just like the work of Santa Claus. It's not going away anytime soon. Right? So, all right. Now, once I've got your mind fixed on Santa Claus, right? And now that Santa Claus is loaded. It's not just, it's an example, but it's about the Buddhist doctrine of emptiness. It's about true truth. So now I can start to play with it. And this is how koan literature works. They completely play with this kind of thing. So let's say an earnest Zen student comes to the Zen teacher and says, by practicing Zazen, can I attain awakening? Can I attain Buddhahood? And the teacher says, on Donder, on Blitzen. Okay? Now, most of you get that. I mean, but what do you have to know? You have to know that. How does that poem go? You know, it occurred to me
the night before Christmas,
right? Can anyone recite it? So, you know, if you don't have that cultural background, if I told that on Donder, on Blitzen, you know, I'm even worried. I mean, in Miami, maybe, you know, this is a multicultural city. I don't know. I mean, that's actually German. Donder is thunder and Blitzen is lightning, right? It's the name of the reindeer, of Santa Claus. But, you know, if you don't know the Santa Claus story and that song and everything else, when the Zen master says, on Donder, on Blitzen, you're like, whoa. That guy must be really enlightened because I don't understand it. How stupid that is. So, you know, if you're going to understand Zen koans, obviously it requires understanding this massive literature and the entire culture. And because they were in Confucian China, the Donder and Blitzen stories that everyone knew were stories from Chinese literature and Chinese poetry and so it makes translating this stuff into English terribly hard.
Yeah.
Because you really need to, you know, get all the background. So you get these massive footnotes, okay? Mm-hmm. What I translate, like telling the who's Santa Claus, Donner and Blitzen story, blah blah blah, 3-page footnote on one line.
Yeah.
And Dogen's Shobo Genzo. But that's the kind of translation work we're doing. How am I doing for time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Yeah, now have I gotten to my topic? I didn't get to my topic. I'll tell you a little bit, but if you're really interested, you should go buy the book that's being advertised out on the table there. Stephen Hines edited volume on Dogen, because I have a chapter in there which discusses Dogen's use of koans at length. But anyway, maybe I'll read you an example of how Dogen used koans. You know, I only have 5 minutes, so I'll sort of summarize a couple of things. He does two things that are really, really different from a lot of other Zen masters. One, he loves the Lotus Sutra because he was a Tendai school monk, and the Lotus Sutra is right at the heart of that tradition. And he knows it inside out. And when he is writing about monastic discipline or other things, he likes to quote the Lotus Sutra. But then he loves to take koans and use them as commentary on the Lotus Sutra. And it's a very different kind of rhetoric, the language of the Lotus Sutra and the language of Zen koans. But in Dogen's mind, they are essentially talking about the same thing. You know, one of the ways in which the Zen tradition is often described by itself and by outsiders too is that there should be no dependence on the written word or a transmission of it's outside the teachings, like a transmission that's apart from the sutras. Now, I mean, Dogen didn't buy into that kind of thing at all. He thought that the words of the Buddha or the sutras have the same truth as the words of the Zen ancestors or the patriarchs. And they're really talking about the same thing. So he's perfectly happy commenting on the Lotus Sutra and other sutras with Zen koans. And you know, that's not unique in the Zen tradition, but Dogen does it a lot. The other thing that he does that really is unique is that he comments on monastic rules, rules of purity or shingi, using koans. And I'll give you an example by a time. This is a quote. So this is from Dogen's admonitions for the chef, Tenzo Kyokun. So he quotes a Chinese text called The Rules of Purity for Chan Monasteries, Chanyuan Qingwei or Japanese Zen and Shingi. He says, if the six flavors are not refined, the rules of purity for Chan monasteries say, now he's quoting this Chinese monastic rule, if the six flavors are not refined and the three virtues are not provided, then it cannot be said that the chef has served the assembly. That's the end of the quote. Now here's Dogen talking. He says, when examining the rice, first check for sand. When examining the sand, first check for rice. If you pay careful attention to detail, watching when coming and watching when going, then your mind cannot be scattered, and the food will naturally be replete with the three virtues and endowed with the six flavors. And now here he drops in a koan. When Shuifeng resided at Dongshan Monastery, he served as chef. This is a quotation from a Chinese text. One day he was sifting rice. When he was sifting rice, Dongshan, the master, asked him, are you sifting the sand and removing the rice, or sifting the rice and removing the sand? Shuifeng said, sand and rice are simultaneously removed. Dongshan asked, what will the great assembly eat? Shuifeng overturned the bowl. And Dongshan said, in the future you'll go and be scrutinized by someone else, because he goes and gets a different teacher. And then Dogen, now here's Dogen talking again. In the past, eminent men in possession of the way practiced in this way as chefs, working energetically with their own hands. In this latter day, how can we are so late getting started be negligent about this? And he goes on. But so you have a very interesting mixture there of quotations of Chinese monastic rules, which in the Chinese monastic rules had no koans in them at all. They're a completely different genre. And Dogen thinks that it's perfectly appropriate to use koans to comment on those monastic rules. So he uses koans in ways that no one, I mean, this is something no one else ever did. And I'd be interested if anyone knows of someone else using koans in that way, but I think Dogen's, as far as I can tell, unique in that respect. Let me see. I have lots of examples here of koans that he used. Maybe I'll just give you one more, and then we can I'll be done.
Two more.
Okay. So in there's a chapter of Shobo Genzo called Sutra Reading, Kankin, which I translated. And he cites this koan, and then I'll give you his commentary on the koan. So first of all, this is a quotation of the Chinese original. Dogen gives it. It says, the ancient ancestor, great master Hongdao of Yueshan, ordinarily did not permit people to engage in sutra reading. One day, he took hold of a sutra and perused it himself. A monk asked, the reverend teacher ordinarily does not permit people to engage in sutra reading. Why, on the contrary, are you yourself reading? The master said, as for me, I need only shield my eyes. It's okay for me to read. I just shield my eyes, he says. Right? The monk said, if I follow the method of the reverend teacher, will it work? The master said, if you were to read, even oxhide would be transparent. So, in other words, oxide is a very thick, like, if you had an oxide shield on, even with that, you wouldn't be able to shield your eyes. Okay? I could tell you what I think that means, but no, let's let Dogen. Here's Dogen's commentary. So, Dogen says, this saying, I need only shield my eyes, is the self-expression of one with shielded eyes. To shield the eyes is to forget the eyes. It's to forget the sutra. It's the shielding of the entire eye. It's to entirely shield the eye. To shield the eyes is to open the eyes while shielded. It's the living eye behind the shield. It's the living shield behind the eye. It's a layer of skin added to the skin of the eye. It's to hold up the eye behind the shield. It's the eye beholding itself holding up the shield. Thus, if it's not the eye sutra, there's still no merit in shielding the eye. As for even oxide would be transparent, now he quotes it again, he's commenting on that part, it's the hide of the entire ox. It's the ox of the entire hide. It's to hold up the ox and prepare the hide. For this reason, I regard the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, the horns on the head, and the nose as the livelihood of the ox. In following the method of the reverend teacher, to shield the eyes is for the ox to function as eyes. It's for the eyes to function as the ox. Now that's Dogen, right? You're like, whoa, what is he talking about? Well, you know, he really gets into it. But, you know, sutra reading is one of the things that Dogen is supposed to have said you shouldn't do. You know, in the passage where he says, just sit in meditation, don't read sutras, don't make prostrations, don't burn incense, don't contemplate the Buddha, his very famous passage. He has a whole chapter in Shoto Gezo. It's very obvious that he thinks sutra reading is extremely important, and he loves the Lotus Sutra, and he quotes other sutras. So this is not meant to be taken literally that you don't read sutras. And also, to chant sutras to make merit, he's big into that too, don't he? And it's not just reading for meaning, but it's reading to produce merit, the dedication. And all the rituals of that, Dogen explains in great detail, and it's obvious that they took place at his monastery. Donors come, they make prayers, the monks chant sutras, they dedicate the merit in support of those prayers. You know, this is what modern Soto Zen calls superstition. And they try to say, Dogen doesn't have that. Well, unless you read them, then there it is. Okay? But I would say about this, there's a difference, you know, there's a right way to read sutras and there's a wrong way to read sutras. That's what the koan is. Mm-hmm. Why can the master read sutras? Because he doesn't get attached, right? He can, like, there's a right way to deal with Santa Claus and there's a wrong way to deal with Santa Claus, okay? I could tell the Santa Claus story and then, you know, after the kids go to sleep, I go up and get the presents where I hid them and I stick them under the tree. That's the right way to understand Santa Claus. The wrong way to understand Santa Claus is you tell the story to your kids, you go to bed, you get up in the morning, and you're all disappointed. So, you know, if you read sutras in the wrong way, right, you're going to be disappointed. You can't be attached to the words, and there's no such thing. Now read the sutras and understand. Okay? All right. I think I'm done. I'm ready for questions.
Okay. Questions? Yes.
I'm just curious. Can we assume that Dogen's followers would also know the same obscure koan that he's referencing, or at least would have access to them to potentially find them later on, or would they presumably be suffering under the same confusion as later translators?
Yeah, the question was, can we assume that Dogen's audience had the same sort of wealth of knowledge about the tradition? And I think we can assume it, yeah. You know, his Shobo Genzo chapters are probably, whether he wrote them or whether they were his notes or whether someone else, you know, edited them later, but they were evidently talks he gave to his monastic community, not in a large public gathering, but in a small gathering called Shosan, like a small gathering of him and his monks where he gives them instruction. So often, I think the Shobo Genzo chapter that's left assumes that they've already been talking about some other text. Like, he's already prepared them. Like, I mean, it'd be as if, you know, in any college class, if you saw some lecture notes the students took, you know, of what went on in the class, there's a lot assumed there. Like, what was the assigned reading? Okay? That's what they're talking about, but the student knows what it was, and that's not actually in the notes. So there's this sort of implicit knowledge of what's of the topic, you know. But of course, Dogen is modeling this kind of. The Japanese monks he was teaching were not so familiar with the Chinese Chan tradition, so he probably left some of them in the dark, you know, a lot of the time. But yeah.
Yes.
Thank you for a wonderful. Stand up. Thank you for a wonderful lecture. It was really interesting. And my question was, as you point out, the insight is already so wonderfully contained in the koan. This is the census, a question about whether or not the king of France has hair is only meaningful insofar as we know as France being a republic. And so my question is, since the koans are already so poignant, why does Dogen need to invert them? For instance, when he says only a painted rice cake can truly satisfy hunger, mm-hmm. He changes the original form of the koan. Why does he
okay.
need to do that?
Right. The question is, why does Dogen need to say something else? The koans seem to be complete in themselves, or is it so poignant? Why does he need to turn them around? Like only a painted, like Yunmen says, you know, obviously a painted rice cake, like a picture of a of a cake is not going to satisfy your hunger, right? But Dogen says only a painted rice cake. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you follow what I said about the doctrine of emptiness and doctrine of two truths, any statement, including Jiaozhou's famous wu, is defective. Right? And there's a dialectic here, because he said something. In fact, not only words, but it perhaps any attempt to signify something is defective. You know, there's a very famous story about Vimalakirti and how he answers with silence. You see? But from in the koan tradition, you'd say, Vimalakirti is a loud mouth. Because his silence signifies something. As a matter of fact, his silence means the ultimate truth cannot be said. Mm-hmm. Blah, 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 right? So he deserves a hit. Okay. Now Dogen wants to turn that around. So he's doing exactly the same kind of thing. That you follow? I mean, you have to, whoever is the judge now on an earlier case has to point out how that earlier case, because it's all cases and all languages on the level of conventional truth. So it's always wrong. It always needs to be judged wrong. And as soon as you say no such thing, which is the ultimate judgment, you're wrong. And you're going to be judged. Because thing is, you know, that you just contradicted yourself. You used the concepts. All right? So there's only conventional truth. Yes. And it's always wrong. Yeah.
I get concerned about, from that perspective, the inadvertent over-privileging with silence. And mm-hmm. close to my mind, a line from one of Dogen's poems that goes something like, words express the truth, they do not exhaust the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if you could comment on that in terms of that. Well, you know, what you are saying is, and as soon as we say something, it's kind of wrong, but it's kind
but,
of.
But also, there's nothing right. There's also nothing right unless we keep talking. I mean, that's what's very strange about this. It's not a question of just plain silence, like. Dogs don't have very advanced language. They you know, understand a few human words. So is that absence of, does that make them, you know, really profound Zen masters and Buddhas and everything?
Yes.
In order to understand, so ultimate truth, as I see it, it is the understanding of the limitations of language. So unless you're talking, you can't understand the limitation of language and conceptual thought. So you need conceptual thought, and actually you need to follow through to the nth degree logically to hit the limit. There's a limit to our understanding of the world. You don't hit that limit if you just like dumb and don't think about it. Dogs do not hit the limit of language. All right? So to hit the limit of language means using language and using it constantly. You know, the Zen tradition in the Chinese Buddhist canon has by far the most massive amount of literature. And they're all saying the same thing. They're all saying, you know, Santa Claus. Now, how many ways can you say Santa Claus? And you've got to keep telling the story over and over and over and over and over, and over again. Keep talking. Yeah.
I'm curious. I thought it was interesting about the digital search of the Chinese canon for the quotes. I'm wondering, is there a concordance of Dogen that exists? I've seen one in English. Is there one in Japanese?
A concordance?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, it's not exactly a concordance, but there's a famous professor, Kaga Mishima, who has, back in 1965, and then there was an update a couple decades later. Yeah. They take master by master.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are books that try to identify the quotations that this is what Professor Hines is talking about. It's not exactly a concordance. Yeah. But, you know, all concordances nowadays are more or less useless with electronic search.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, question over there?
Yeah, koans, aren't they more of a direct pointing to something here and now? I was under the impression that when Ungwan was asked what is Buddha, he was leaving an outhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ask me what is Buddha, I could say wood paneling with fern. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that something more direct and to the point?
Jingle bells. Yeah, maybe, but you know what? I smell a stinky whiff of attachment. You know, really, I mean, you think it's just like saying what's ever there in front of you? If we say oak tree in the garden's in front of you right now. Right? You don't have to be there. That's too literalistic. Yeah.
One more, or that put the silence.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, wait, one more. Footnote.
What was the question?
Are there other sutras like that that follow the same thought belief that sort of just.
Well, what I was reading about is not the sutra, that was Dogen's comment on the koan. And Dogen talks like that a lot, yes. He does. But it's not very common. That style of language is not common in Buddhist sutras at all.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.